Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
As Florida school districts wrestle with ways to prevent another Parkland-type tragedy, hospitals are also developing their own violence response and prevention plans.
Being in a posture of prevention is just the best way to do business.
The push for political term limits is back in style, although promises by a certain Florida senatorial candidate to impose those limits on other federal lawmakers is anything but certain.
He has no chance of making that happen if he is elected to Congress. The court has already ruled on this, the Supreme Court.
We'll also find out if Florida teachers are going to go on strike, as teachers in some other states are, and we'll visit an actual food desert in the very shadow of the Florida Capitol. I'm Tom Flanagan. Welcome to Capitol Report. Since February's Marjorie Stoneman Douglas school shooting, Florida's school districts have been grappling with how to keep campuses safe without creating too much stress or disruption for students. From member station WLRN in Miami, Jessica Bakeman reports that hospitals are now trying to strike that balance, too. Hospitals in Broward County had to make some tough calls during the Parkland tragedy, and the effects were felt well beyond the immediate community.
On the afternoon of February 14th, Fawn Patterson got a call from her daughter telling her to come to the hospital.
Yeah, we're on lockdown, so nobody comes in.
When Patterson got to Broward Health Medical Center in Fort Lauderdale, a security guard was blocking the door.
I have a daughter up there that's 7 months pregnant, bleeding, and I can't get in to see her.
Patterson was one of dozens of people waiting for hours on the sidewalk outside the emergency room.
Very frustrated, very angry, and very upset.
A lockdown is simply a security measure for the protection of the victims, their family, as well as the physicians and staff.
Dr. Lewis Yogel, chief of medical staff, addressed the media that night. Both his hospital and Broward Health North in Deerfield Beach had gone into lockdowns after receiving victims of the shooting. They're both part of the same public system. The people in charge of hospital security at Broward Health and elsewhere say a lockdown is standard and necessary to keep all patients safe when they're treating victims of a violent incident.
In a time of crisis like this, it's better to have control.
But for people caught in the middle of the chaos, the lockdowns were distressing, and they demonstrated the far-reaching ripple effects of a mass shooting on an entire community.
So you're saying we can't go in for my daughter's birth?
During the lockdown at the hospital in Fort Lauderdale, people crowded the entrance to the ER, trying to persuade security to let them in.
I got a kid though in there that needs to go to school tomorrow.
There was a woman there trying to visit her friend who was dying of cancer. Another woman had a newborn son in the NICU who was breathing through a tube. Fawn Patterson's daughter, Amanda Ray Carrillo, was in a hospital room watching news of the shooting on TV with her husband, Roberto Gonzalez. Gonzalez said he felt vulnerable with his pregnant wife and children at the hospital.
It was very scary, very traumatic.
But the security did make him feel a little better. At one point, the couple heard that Nicholas Cruz, the confessed shooter, was being treated at that hospital. That turned out not to be true. But at the time, they were worried what might happen.
You don't know if somebody's going to come to the hospital to try to hurt that boy.
That's exactly the kind of thing hospitals are worried about.
Being in a posture of prevention is just the best way to do business.
Brian Margeson is corporate security manager for Orlando Health, a private hospital chain that treated victims of the Pulse nightclub shooting 2 years ago. He said when a mass casualty incident is the result of violence, hospital administrators consider worst-case scenarios, like a shooting suspect coming to the hospital to further harm the victims, someone trying to retaliate against the perpetrator, or dozens of people rushing the hospital in a panic. Ramping up security?
It's a proactive stance.
When there's a crisis at one of Margeson's hospitals, security guards patrol the entrances, questioning people about why they need to come in. If they aren't seeking medical care, they're not a high priority.
Our first and foremost responsibility is treating the patients, and that overrides everything.
Fawn Patterson ended up going home on the night of the shooting without getting to see her daughter, but everything turned out okay for her family. Amanda Ray Carrillo was treated for the bleeding and released from the hospital the next day. And on April 16th, she welcomed her fifth child, Amaya Gonzalez.
She's beautiful. She's a perfect little girl.
When Carrillo was back at that same hospital 2 months after the shooting for her daughter's birth, her mom was sitting by her bedside.
Wow, she's got some fingernails.
Hi, baby.
Margeson, the security chief in Orlando, said preparing hospitals for potential problems after violent incidents is like seeing a tornado warning on TV and bringing your patio set inside.
You may or may not suffer the consequences of the bad weather, and your furniture never would have been destroyed or flipped over or blown into the pool.
But, he said, it's important to take precautions. For Health News Florida, I'm Jessica Bakeman in Fort Lauderdale.
When Governor Rick Scott rolled out the first TV ad in his campaign for U.S. Senate, it centered entirely on his desire to bring 12-year term limits to Congress. Meanwhile, this week saw the retirement of Senate President Joe Negron, who says he's a big believer in term limits. The conversation has even reached the Constitution Revision Commission with a proposal that would limit school board members to 8-year terms. Florida Public Radio's Ryan Daly recently talked with Professor Daniel Smith, chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Florida, to talk about why the conversation about term limits is bubbling up in every level of Florida politics.
So, from my understanding, term limits date back as far as ancient Greece, and it sure seems like, based on that, that's been a concern of the public, you know, kind of since the genesis of politics itself. So I guess that makes the big question, do term limits work?
Florida was actually one of the earliest adopters of term limits for both our state House and senators, as well as our members of Congress, passing a measure back in 1992 through the initiative process. It was well over 3 out of 4 voters supported putting 8-year term limits on our state lawmakers. At the congressional level, however, the U.S. Supreme Court opined in 2005 in a case that came out of Arkansas that struck down any of these citizen initiatives that applied to members of Congress. So there's certainly been a long-standing tradition historically, but also a popular notion to put limits on the length of terms of our elected officials at the state as well as the federal level. The court has differed, however, of whether or not citizens could do that, changing the law with respect to the U.S. Constitution.
Is that popularity behind that idea, is that to sort of stave off corruption? Or, you know, why do you think so many people kind of back term limits?
So I think you have to sometimes differentiate between the good governance side of things in principle versus the pure partisan power play that is often behind many of these good governance movements. Now, you asked about, you know, whether or not they actually seem to work, and this idea of rooting out corruption, long-term lawmakers. Certainly, we've seen evidence of that in places like New York and New Jersey that don't have term limits on their state lawmakers. But one would be hard-pressed not to be able to come up with lots of examples of corruption in states that do have term limits. So I don't necessarily think that it's going to root out corruption in our state capitals with these lawmakers who are there for a long time or a truncated time. Nor am I sure that it actually leads to greater accountability in terms of being able to remove these individuals by force after, say, 8 years. Theoretically, you have the opportunity to remove these individuals every 2 years or 4 years in the case of Florida's state House and state Senate. So there are other factors that could lead to greater accountability than a rule change or a constitutional change, such as having a forced retirement through term limits.
As I'm sure you know, Governor Rick Scott, he's made news lately. He wants to implement a 12-year term limit for members of Congress. In your estimation, what chance does a Rick Scott have to make good on bringing term limits to Congress?
Yeah, he has no chance of making that happen if he is elected to Congress. The court has already ruled on this, the Supreme Court. It does make good political theater and good rhetoric. Again, Floridians now 25 years ago voted very affirmatively to do what he is saying that needs to be done today. Of course, the easiest way to have term limits is just not to run for office again. Step down after one term of 6 years as U.S. Senator or two terms as 12 years as U.S. Senator. That would be the easiest way. But of course, most members don't do that. And it's very easy to call for term limits when you're outside of power. It's a very different thing to see whether or not members honor their pledge. When that movement in the early 1990s was going on, calling nationwide for greater term limits on elected members, there were these term limit pledges that candidates would sign. And of course, they were completely meaningless, that you would take this campaign pledge, that you would serve only 4 or 6 terms in office and then step down. And most of these members who signed actually didn't follow through on that because, you know, it's a learning process. They're just getting good at their job. The citizens need them. They're really working for the people and finally now have moved up in the ranks of power to be able to do good work. And so those pledges, whether or not it's on a campaign ad or a sheet of paper, have really led to very little movement.
Well, Professor Smith, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate you weighing in on all this, and thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Still to come on Capitol Report, there are a lot of public school teachers walking off the job in a number of states right now. Could such a thing happen in Florida? And if not, why not?
You know, laws were put in place where we can't walk off the job.
Don't tell the residents of so-called food deserts that the miracle of the marketplace will eventually bring fresh fruits and vegetables to their neighborhoods.
We have to require our officials to implement a policy for this area.
And we'll go for a bike ride, but we'll be really careful because nationwide the number of bike crashes is going up and cyclists are asking drivers to use a little more caution.
It's good to have a little more awareness for it, for drivers on the road.
Teachers in several states have gone on strike in recent months, protesting for better pay and working conditions. But that's not the case in Florida, and likely will never be. Still, once upon a time, Florida led the first teacher strike in the United States. Lynn Hatter takes us back in time to report on what the state of public education was like back then.
In 1967, Claude Kirk became the first Republican governor elected in Florida since Reconstruction. And in his inaugural speech, he made a promise.
No longer can we afford to mark time while other states pursue and capture educational excellence. Florida must be number one in education.
So in 1968, Governor Kirk ran as being the education governor. And when he got here, he did anything but help the public education system.
Joanne McCall leads Florida's largest teachers union, the Florida Education Association. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the 1968 Florida teacher walkout. Instead of more money for education, Governor Kirk pitched funding cuts.
And teachers across this state had really just had enough. So they gathered at what was what is the Citrus Bowl now in Orlando, the old Tangerine Bowl is what it was called then. They gathered and they had this big rally.
Every time they'd hear somebody talk about doing more for education, they knew it was just talk and they'd get madder.
The schools were not well built, they were old.
We walked out because we didn't have books like we should have had.
Question of more money just on our salaries was not a priority item at all. It was basically just for better conditions for the students.
Those are the voices of past FEA leaders in a union-produced documentary on the hows and whys of the walkout. Former FEA Executive Secretary Phil Constance on the growing frustration. Union Treasurer Bob Lee on school conditions, Ulysses Black on the lack of books, and Indian River County teacher Edna Tate. After that gathering in Orlando, Governor Kirk convened a special session of the legislature on education. Nothing came of it. And so?
On February 19, 1968, 35,000 resignations from Florida teachers were activated. It was the first statewide teachers' strike in U.S. history.
I'll never forget the governor of Florida flying in from California.
Pat Tornillo served as head of the Classroom Teachers Association during that time.
And announcing to everyone that he was going to come to Miami if I would invite him to speak to the 6,000 teachers in Marine Stadium, and he would convince them, if he could only have the opportunity to talk to them, that they had made a mistake, and convince them to go back to the classroom.
Kirk's speech to the teachers didn't work. The strike went on for 3 weeks. But at the time, there were no immediate gains. Eventually, teachers went back to work. Some lost their jobs. Yet in 1974, the state passed a collective bargaining law, allowing the union to negotiate on behalf of teachers with their employers. From there, teachers earned paid holidays and an employer-backed retirement, today's state pension.
But with that comes great penalties. Laws were put in place where we can't walk off the job.
Current FEA President Joanne McCall says the 1968 walkout did come at a cost. While it was the first in the nation, it was also the last in the state. Today, public employees, including teachers, are barred from striking under both the Florida Constitution and state law. And if they do, they face hefty penalties. Teachers could lose their teaching certificates, have their pay frozen, and employees at large risk their retirements. Yet McCall admits Florida teachers are still reaping the benefits from that strike.
Do we deserve more and should be there great more pay? Absolutely, there should be more pay. But there have been raises. Whereas when you look at Oklahoma, they haven't had raises in 9 years. They have 40 kids in the classroom. We aren't following our class size amendment, but it's probably not that egregious.
In recent years, Florida lawmakers have pulled back from fully funding public employee retirements and requiring employees to contribute 3%. The state has also eased up on requirements of the class size amendment, which dictates the number of kids in a classroom. It eliminated tenure for new educators, and it's made big changes in how public schools are funded, even establishing what critics call competing systems through charter schools and private school scholarship programs. Teacher evaluations are tied to student test scores in a way even courts have said is questionable.
Are our people angry? Yes. They're very angry. And when you watch social media, there's a lot of, let's do this, let's do that. And I have to try to caution my people to follow the law. Mm-hmm. Because we can't, it would be irresponsible as the state president to ask my people to go ahead and strike and then jeopardize their retirement and their certificate. So there's penalties for the individuals, but there's also penalties for the union.
In its biography of Governor Kirk, the State Archives, FloridaMemory.com, notes he went on to make big gains in improving water quality and approving a new state constitution. Yet it also says, quote, as governor, he resisted the efforts of teachers to conduct a statewide walkout and opposed the court-ordered forced busing program. Kirk lost his 1970 re-election bid. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
With diabetes and other health threats on the rise in communities around Florida, researchers are trying to address the underlying causes of those health disparities. Devondra Alston reports what are called food deserts appear to be a serious contributing factor, and researchers suggest education and access to healthier foods would greatly improve residents' quality of life.
Just north of Florida State University, a small area in Tallahassee called Frenchtown has minimal food access.
Frenchtown is actually a pretty big food desert, so in that sense, we're trying to like kind of resolve that issue. So like in this, like with this garden we have over here, we have composting, so...
Winsley Darius is a volunteer for iGrow Community. iGrow is an initiative to sell food to communities in food deserts. It has two locations. Both are looking for volunteers to help produce fruits and vegetables.
Give me a shout if y'all need me, okay?
All right, good.
Okay, all right. All right, thank y'all.
Igro farmer Sundiata Amael says residents in food-stricken areas should educate themselves on healthier foods to eat.
You know, you have record numbers of young people with diabetes, high cholesterol, high blood pressure. All of these things are usually food-related. So if we knew how to avoid those things by simply changing our eating habits, then we'd be on our way to basically saving our own lives.
The other Igro is on the south side of Tallahassee, where grocery stores are hard to find in close range, yet corner stores and fast food restaurants are plentiful. Every Tuesday, a food truck makes its way to the south side in an empty lot on Orange Avenue, distributing dry foods from Second Harvest. Low-income residents stop by to sign up for boxes listing how many live in their household and contact information. Winn-Dixie on South Adams Street closed down for good and left many residents searching for fresh produce.
That left us in a lurch, basically on this side of town.
FAMU Research Coordinator Cynthia Seaborn says Piggly Wiggly on the south side was the only grocer willing to move in one of the vacant lots.
I'm not sure, so I would be really speaking out of school. I'm not sure if they have a criteria, you meet this, because basically they have fresh fruits and vegetables. You know, so they have the things that we say that we want, but what's the quality?
Consumers on the south side argue that the cost and quality of the produce isn't as good as any other competing grocer and still puts their health at risk. Seaborn?
Short of getting an organization owned by us, ran by us, and for us, we have to require our officials to implement a policy for this area. And then when you look zip code wise, and you'll probably get this from the Department of Health, but when you look zip code wise and you see the occurrences of certain diseases, you can't help but to think that food insecurity, there's a direct correlation to that.
In economics, the laws of supply and demand are also in play.
It's perceived that low income won't purchase food, but I purchase what you provide me a lot of times. And see, I think that that's a fallacy, that we won't purchase food as in this side of town.
They want to cook. They're going to use these onions and they're going to cook food, use this spinach and this kale, and make healthy meals for themselves.
But those taking advantage of the produce from Igro aren't the ones Igro Sundiata Amael set out to help.
The majority of the people who buy through this online venue are usually Caucasian, upper high middle class, right? Or upper middle class, high class, or upper class, however you categorize those things, and on the north side of town. So, you know, we're dealing with people who are educated in terms of why these foods are important. But the people who don't know are the ones that need the most help.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Devondra Alston.
Florida is hiring 5 cybersecurity specialists in advance of the 2018 elections, even though the legislature did not include those positions when setting the state budget for the upcoming fiscal year. Governor Rick Scott announced the move this week to hire consultants who will work with elections officials. According to the Department of State, the money will come from the agency's federal trust fund for the current and upcoming fiscal years. Back in March, U.S. Senator Marco Rubio warned of a level of overconfidence, as he called it, about the security of the nation's election system heading into this year's elections. Florida is one of several states where voter rolls were believed to have been targeted by Russian hackers before the 2016 presidential election. Florida officials have not disclosed what exactly transpired during that election. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally, this week, across the country, the number of people killed in bike crashes is on the rise. AAA reports in 2016, 840 bicyclists died in crashes, the highest number since 1991. In Florida, the Department of Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles reports more than 6,000 crashes in 2017, 940 of which ended in fatalities or incapacitating injuries. We get more on that story from Regan McCarthy.
As the weather warms up, more people are beginning to switch from four wheels to two. To help people prepare, the Tallahassee-Leon County Planning Department held a bike expo. Here, cyclists can get a quick tune-up, learn about new trails, and get a refresher on safety. Christian Grief uses an electric bike to commute to class at Florida A&M University nearly every day. He says on his ride, safety is often top of mind.
I usually actually ride in the center of the lane, so because I ride faster, it makes it to where cars aren't really passing me all the time, so that kind of makes me like another vehicle on the road.
But Grief says he wishes more drivers would be thinking about safety too.
I feel like drivers need to be more aware about other bikes on the road, because sometimes they don't feel like they're not able to gauge how fast I am moving. So at times, like in a roundabout or other places on the road, some cars will turn in front of me thinking that I'll be a lot slower. And by doing so, there's a conflict there which could result in a wreck or something.
Grief says while his bike is fast as an electric bike, regular old leg-powered cycles can pick up speed too.
Some bicyclists, they ride on road bikes, they're able to hit 30 miles an hour as well, so I think in general, even not even for e-bikes, but for other bikes as well, it's good to have a little more awareness for it for drivers on the road.
Greg Slay is the executive director of the Capital Region Transportation Planning Agency. He says planners and local governments can help too by providing safer places for cyclists to ride. He says concerns about safety can be a barrier for some riders.
You know, they don't want to ride directly on the roadway, so they're looking for those alternate paths that they do feel safer and more comfortable riding on those. So that's definitely always a factor.
Meanwhile, Captain Tom Peichel with the Florida Department of Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles says some of the onus for making a ride safer also falls on the cyclists themselves.
For instance, a bicyclist and their passengers, if they're under the age of 16, are required to wear helmets. And for that matter, it's recommended that all bicyclists wear helmets for their safety. Also, bicyclists should not wear headphones or earbuds, just as if you wouldn't wear a headset while you're driving a car. And then, of course, it's important to note that between the hours of sunset and sunrise, that bicyclists are required to have a white visible light that is visible from 500 feet from the front of the bicycle.
Peichel also reminds riders bicycles are vehicles and have all the privileges and responsibilities of a car moving down the road. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Ryan Daly, Lynn Hatter, and Regan McCarthy. We also thank Jessica Bateman and Devondra Alston. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And please join us each week at this time for more reports from the state capitol. Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.